This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We like to think class distinctions are silly, but if so, why do people still have fun watching HMS Pinafore?
Rafe, who was the sailor, and the captain were switched at birth. And so in reality, the captain is now lower class and Rafe is higher class. So Rafe can marry Josephine.
Bob Mangiolardi invites us to join in the silliness of Gilbert and Sullivan as the Prairie Fire Theater production gets underway later this week. Plus, Normal City Manager Pam Reese updates us on a variety of projects and potential initiatives, from the Trail East project to the Uptown Underpass to road repair season. Eric Stock has more on the Italian Odyssey of the ISU men's basketball team, and Ryan Denham talks carbon footprint and other issues with the new Director of Sustainability for ISU. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Trail East project moves ahead. It's high season for street repairs in the Twin Cities, and a recent kerfuffle about council member protocol raises some history questions. Joining us to talk about these and other issues is Normal City Manager Pam Reese. This is a fifth Tuesday of the month. Usually on Tuesdays, we have the mayors of Bloomington Normal on to talk about the council meetings and other issues. But without a Monday meeting, we're catching up with the city managers this week. Yesterday, we heard from Tim Gleason of Bloomington, and today, welcome Pam Reese.
Well, thank you, Charlie. It's good to be here.
In July of last year, a consultant gave Bloomington and Normal a study showing $40 to $50 million in multi-sport complex is a viable idea through a public-private partnership. Bloomington, Normal, and the Bloomington Normal Area Convention and Visitors Bureau split the cost of that $47,000 study. At the time, the study indicated there was a relatively narrow window of time to consider the study valid before conditions change enough to make it obsolete. I believe the window might have been a year and a half. We're coming up on that in a few more months. Early on, the town met with a potential developer. Nothing public ever came of that. Where does this idea stand now?
Well, you are correct. It was in the study, the consultant indicated that the data and the metrics and the evaluation was good for about an 18-month period. Beyond an 18-month period, then we should reevaluate those numbers and see what's changed. So we're at the 12-month mark. Where the concept stands, though, is it's been on the back burner for a while. There have been other priorities and other projects I think both municipalities have been focusing on. So now it's time to reintroduce the conversation. Tim Gleason, the city manager of Bloomington, and I are going to be talking with representatives of the Sports Commission through the Convention and Visitors Bureau soon and talking about what steps can we take to either move this to the front burner and get going again, or put this to rest. I'm confident that it is still a viable solution. Sports tourism is truly, it's a thing. And a lot of communities are relying on that. The question is whether or not the Bloomington Normal community can get a piece of that action. And I think we can, so we're gonna start conversations soon to bring it hopefully that will result in bringing it back to the front burner.
Is there still a potential private partner to this public-private partnership?
We haven't identified a specific private partner, but I do know through conversations with others that there is interest. And so I think that once we talk to the Sports Commission and talk to Mayor Coos and Mayor Renner to find out if they're ready to move this forward into a public conversation and see if we can find a private partner to come along, then I'm sure we can move forward.
So what's your timeline for Sports Commission and then coming back to council with a report that it's either a thumbs up or a meh or a thumbs down? You like my meh?
Yeah,
there?
Exactly, the meh. I'm hopeful within 30 days we can know something. That might be a little optimistic, but let's say 30 to 45 days, hopefully we'll have some direction and some guidance on how we can move forward, if we want to move forward at all. And I'm still hopeful we can. I do think the Bloomington Normal community could take advantage of sports tourism. one other piece of that the project, though, is identifying a location. And in the Bloomington-Normal area, we think there's probably six or so viable locations where there might be 120-ish acres, you know, that might be readily available, that might have utility services and such. So that all will be part of the discussion.
Last week, Illinois State University trustees approved leasing space for a business incubator in the Trail East building on Uptown Circle when it is built. Update us on how the rest of that project is moving, would you?
Well, that was very exciting news. I'm thrilled to hear that the incubator will be part of the Trail East project. We will be talking at our biweekly meetings this week, later this week, with Bush Development. Bush, at this point, I think, is on a fall timeline. Every time, you know, it's a major $30 million plus project, and so construction timelines tend to not be what we hoped they would be. There's usually some hurdles along the way, but for right now, they're looking at a fall timeline for demolition and starting construction. Their original project, I think, was about an 18-month construction. I don't recall the exact timeline. So the town will... We don't want to be in a position to hold up their development, and so we will be planning to move forward with relocation of the mural, get that out of the way so that they can then demolish the properties and get going with construction and steel in the ground and such.
Well, you win. You were the first person to mention mural. I did have it on my mind. So where stands the settlement talks or the lawsuit issue?
Well, the lawsuit issue is still outstanding. At this point, I believe that the lawsuit will be delayed until any possible action in the spring. In the meantime, the town will move forward with relocation, and if something happens during the relocation, then we can determine if there's reason to move forward with any kind of legal action in the spring. So,
what
I would
say,
mean
something happens.
Well, if it doesn't survive a relocation or something, if we're grossly negligent in relocating it, then I suppose there would be an ability to sue the town. But if we are successful in our plan to move forward and relocate the mural, then we get it out of the way, hopefully this fall, so that Bush Development can demolish the remaining buildings of 104, 106, and 108 East Beaufort. And once we relocate the mural, get it stabilized and secure, and if all goes well, there should be no basis for a lawsuit.
We're only about a month away from it being fall. Where are you going to put it?
Well, we are working out the final details of the location. So we expect that it's going to be located somewhere in Uptown. I can't identify the actual location quite yet.
When construction starts, how will the town handle traffic issues through there?
Well, we have survived lots and lots of construction in Uptown. You know, the One Uptown Circle, the Uptown Station, Children's Discovery Museum started it all off. So there will be traffic interruptions and there will be inconveniences. We try to minimize the inconveniences as much as possible for the businesses in Uptown and certainly the visitors to Uptown. But at this point, my guess is most of the interruption will be on Constitution Boulevard and East Beaufort. And there might be occasions when perhaps a lane of College Avenue might be off limits. But we, again, will try to minimize that as much as possible. We work with the developers to have their construction staging that tries to reduce the inconvenience.
So will there be a limitation of traffic into and out of Uptown that would require assistance from the town and business disruption?
Well, I don't know that we've done anything like that in the past, other than, do you mean like financial assistance?
Yeah. Or what? So for instance, I believe there was some business disruption help maybe 15 years ago when the entire area was torn up to replace the underground infrastructure in
right.
Uptown.
That involved tearing up most of the streets and a lot of dirt and holes. So in this particular instance, I think there's alternative ways To get in and out of Uptown because of all the improvements we've made in the last 15 years. So I have not been, we have not had conversations in regard to that kind of interruption.
So how about Windy City Wieners, which is in one of the buildings that's scheduled to be torn down, and they're scheduled to be a tenant of the new food area in Trail East. Will they receive help in business disruption?
That is not from the town. We haven't discussed any arrangements with the town. I believe Windy City Wieners and Bush Development might be working out their final details on how and if they are their businesses interfered or interrupted. So that is between Bush and Windy City.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. With us is Pam Reese, the manager, the city manager for the town of Normal. Across the circle from Trail East is Uptown One. Any word on a potential first floor tenant?
No.
That
I don't
saddens
have any
everyone.
Information. Yes. I wish there was. Occasionally I have conversations with the developer. And I know that they continue to be active in securing a tenant. But frankly, I think once the Trail East project across the circle from them gets going, they truly believe that that will be yet another catalyst for interest in their space. So,
does their failure to find and provide a tenant so far put them in danger of being in violation of their development agreement?
I don't believe so. I think the development agreement, that's certainly a legal issue, but it's my understanding that the development agreement identified preferred tenants and preferred timelines, but not guarantees.
Well, we're on Uptown. How about the potential underpass to connect Uptown and Uptown South? There's been a request for federal funds in the hopper for some time. As we saw with the money for Uptown Station, it can take years before a good project can get grant approval. Any movement from the feds?
Well, about a week or so ago, we submitted a build grant to the Department of Transportation and in the latest round of grants. And so we're very hopeful. We hope to hear something by October. And this is yet another application to the Department of Transportation for funding to support an underpass construction, which we've always believed would be a catalyst for economic development on the south side of the tracks. It will also improve convenience and safety, and also, in terms of rail passengers, make it much more accessible to get from the north side of the tracks to the south side if you're trying to catch an Amtrak train. So we've submitted our grant application. We're hopeful that it will be successful. We are feeling very optimistic because our last grant application, we received very positive, although it was not funded, we did receive very positive feedback. And so by making some tweaks to our application, we're hopeful that this go around we'll hear positive news.
So what did you have to tweak?
We tweaked some language in our application relative to the more detail of a cost-benefit analysis. And also wanted to continue to tweak some of the language and verbiage that we included regarding the positive impacts of the project.
So how much did you ask the feds for, and how much would the local match be as well?
We believe the project total project cost will be $22 to $24 million. We've asked for $16 million through this build grant program.
So $16 million, and then perhaps $10 million.
$6 to $8 million.
$6 to $8 million.
$6 to $8 million would be local match, but also of that local match, that would incorporate funds from the Illinois Department of Transportation as well. So not necessarily all from the town of Normal.
So how much have you identified from IDOT as potential funding?
You know, I don't want to give you the wrong number, so I was thinking it was between $1 and $2 million, perhaps.
Ish.
Yes, ish. Okay. Exactly. I don't have that sheet right in front of me, and I don't want to specifically identify a number.
Well, a $4 or $5 million local contribution, then, is roughly what we're talking about.
That is true.
Okay. So if that money is available, IDOT plus federal money, will there be council support for that connection between Uptown and Uptown South? The council makeup has changed since this project first came on the scene.
That is true. That's accurate. The council identified this as a priority project for staff for this fiscal year 1920. So that has been our focus. We continue to move forward with that. If council changes their mind, certainly we will adapt. But that would be something that I would rely on Mayor Coos to lead that to facilitate that conversation in terms of if the federal government thinks this is a project worth funding, is this still something the town will commit to? And I'm hopeful. We've put a lot of time and energy into it, and I do think there's very positive impacts that it could have.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Our guest today is Pam Reese, the Normal City Manager. We're talking about all things normal. A recent kerfuffle over a meeting between Councilmember Stan Nord and Bloomington Fire Chief Brian Moore resulted in a letter from Mayor Chris Coos to Bloomington and Normal leaders clarifying town positions on a couple of issues. WGLT obtained a copy of that message, disavowing Nord's approach to asking about consolidating fire departments and his arguable recruitment efforts of a business to take over the town's space on the second floor of Uptown. Mayor Coos said he sent the message to avoid further rumors caused by Nord's action. Nord said he was having personal meetings and intended no rumors. Part of what Stan Nord told WGLT is that his approach to the Bloomington fire chief was intended as self-education, and the history of inter-city governmental cooperation is, I suppose, worth going into as an exercise in public education. There used to be talks between Bloomington and Normal about a joint east side fire station. So why did those come to naught, and how did that situation affect what Councilmember Nord was asking the Bloomington fire chief about combining the two fire departments?
Well, that's a lot of inquiry there, Charlie.
So let's talk about the climate about the East Side Fire Station that mm-hmm. came to naught. What were the factors that resulted in not going forward with that idea?
Well, a couple of years ago, City Manager Mark Peterson at the time shared information with Bloomington former City Manager David Hales regarding what we thought the town could do in terms of constructing a fire station that could serve both Normal and Bloomington. You might recall back in 2014, we went to the Normal City Council and got direction to best serve the east side of Normal. We decided to relocate relocate our three existing fire stations to better serve our community because we're adequately staffed and have appropriate equipment to do that. And so we talked to Bloomington and gave Bloomington some information and a proposal about building, if Normal built a second fire station on the east side, what it would take to staff it accordingly and serve the northeast part of Bloomington. David Hales had determined, I don't know who he spoke with or how he made that determination, but the response we received was that it was not something that Bloomington felt was going to work for them. And I shared that same report with Mr. Gleason, Tim Gleason, when he began his role with the City of Bloomington, just to keep him in the loop, and had indicated that if Bloomington was interested in Normal planning to serve that part of at Bloomington as first responders, then we would need an answer pretty quickly because we were looking at acquiring land elsewhere to accommodate a fire station.
Which you've now done.
Which we have done. And I would say Normal and Bloomington, we get along very well. Things are going along very well between Bloomington administration and all of our departments and the town of Normal as well. But we have different departments. And so Tim also saw the report. I think he probably, my guess is, communicated with his fire chief to see how that would impact their fire operations and determined again that it probably was not something that was in Bloomington's best interest to pursue at the time. So we moved forward, town staff moved forward in recommending property acquisition to best serve town residents.
So it's already actually been revisited since you took the job as city manager and since Tim Gleason took the job as city manager.
That is true. And so I can't comment on Mr. Nord's communication with Bloomington staff. I can certainly indicate that in the spirit of how the town and the city are communicating, getting along, I have very open dialogue with Mr. Gleason almost all the time. And I think Mayor Coos and Mayor Renner do as well. So it's a little bit awkward for an elected official one city to contact a department head or a staff member of another and try to, because the staff member doesn't know what hat they're wearing. And, you know, is the call coming from a citizen or an elected official? And so just to maybe keep the communications clear, I think Mayor Coos was trying to indicate that policymaker to policymaker and city manager to city manager, it might make things less awkward.
To go through that sort of structure and channels. This is Sound Ideas, and we're at 89.1 and WGLT.org. It's high season for street repairs after a really bad winter. Are you finding more damage than you thought? Are you having to adjust your repair structure? And when can we expect to be able to get around without jostling our car suspensions with the pavement that's been scraped off prior to it being repaved, as well as the potholes that are still in progress?
Well, thank you for noticing all the street construction we have going on. It is probably a time of year where I can't imagine people speeding that much because there's a lot of road projects going on that are slow, that's causing traffic to slow down. I can't say that our street projects have increased due to the terrible winter weather we had, but I can tell you that we are spending a lot of time and energy and resources on our roads, and I think that's good. I think that's a sign that we're investing in improving our roads. We also have our public works crews spending quite a bit of time doing some patching of roads. We've got a combination of major street improvement projects and resurfacing that are contracted out, and those projects continue to move forward. Right now we're doing a lot of roads around the campus area and expect to be done before the students move in, so that we should get out of the way.
You have 2 weeks.
Exactly. I know. The contractor's aware of that. But we also have public works crews that were doing areas, for example, Rab Road, west of Linden. They had that shut down for a few days, so our crews were doing improvements and crack sealing in-house. And that does extend the life of our roadway. So we're doing a combination of things. But I can tell you that we're never going to be done. If no matter what the dollar amount available, we would spend it on increasing our roads. So it's nice to make headway, but there will always be a list of roads that will need our attention, and we will continue to focus on that.
Most cities in Illinois are now looking ahead to the start of the new year and the legalization of cannabis. Everybody's going to have to pass their own ordinance. Where are you in developing an ordinance for Normal?
We are in the early stages of addressing that issue. We have received some information from the Illinois Municipal League, who has prepared some model ordinances. They've gathered information, and they're a great resource for us. So we are going to have some dialogue with our elected officials and city council members soon to talk about what is of interest to them. At this point, I can envision that an ordinance that town staff will prepare and present to the city council for consideration will include more zoning type of information in regard to an adult use of cannabis business sales. Where should that be located? And my guess is right now the attention is more along the lines of some sort of regulation comparable to alcohol sales. Limiting the distance from a school and churches and such. So we'll probably have similar kind of restrictions like we see in our alcohol sales ordinance. But we are in the early stages of putting together an ordinance of where that business should be located and as well as where can adult recreational use of cannabis occur. And we would limit in public places.
So the current dispensary could be a a place to buy legally when the law changes as well.
That is true.
Does that violate any of the spacing issues from schools or churches or anything?
I don't believe so.
It's in Far North Normal, so it's not likely to, but you never know.
I think we've already accommodated a similar kind of restriction in terms of the medical sales. So we will look at that. We want to be comprehensive. And so I don't think the ordinance is going to be overly complex that we put together, but there are some municipalities that have taken a position of prohibiting sales altogether. And I don't know if that's where our city council wants to go. I believe that we probably won't take that approach. I think we'll be more of the regulatory in regard to an appropriate location and time. And then we can also regulate like other business restrictions. Time of day, days, just location and time of sales.
So when will that come to the council?
I would suspect that we will have something early fall, perhaps September. The cannabis sales, I think, is going to affect in January of 2020. So that's right around the corner.
So about a month.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
That'll heat up. Pam Reese is the city manager for the town of Normal. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This update. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for WGLT comes from Specs Around Town, proudly investing in downtown Bloomington with a refreshing new look for the boutique at 317 North Center Street. Specs Around Town, Central Illinois' unique optical shop since 1998. Details at specsaroundtown.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is 89.1 and Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, the ISU basketball team is getting ready to head overseas. A university like Illinois State has a ton of competing priorities. Tuition needs to stay affordable, but facilities need to be nice and faculty need to be well paid. The dorm food needs to be good, but meal plans can't cost too much. So where does sustainability fit into that equation? WGLT's Ryan Denham spoke to ISU's new sustainability chief, Elizabeth Reed, about her pitch to campus. They started by talking about the Town of Normal's new multifamily recycling ordinance, which goes into effect Thursday. It requires all landlords to offer recycling as an option to their residents or face $100 a day fines.
This was really a great initiative by our students and obviously our community. But, I really try to encourage our college students to think about themselves not just as they're here for college, but they're citizens here in the town of Normal. And so it's really exciting to see, when they're engaged and involved in certain topics. And this was a great example of that. So the Student Sustainability Committee, which is an external committee on student government, was a real integral part in getting this going, really being voices for the rest of their students and being advocates for this off-campus recycling. So it's really exciting that they, really they're seeing the reality of that happening. Yeah. Even if they already graduated, they might be gone, but they still made an impact on our community.
So as we're several weeks here from the start of the fall semester, what kind of education and outreach do you think ISU will have to do to help make this thing go smoothly and educate students about what you can recycle, what you can't?
Yeah, sure. I think the students are really receptive to this, so I hope that they will be, active with recycling already. They probably grew up with recycling, maybe where they can't, where they were living before, and so hopefully they have it in the dorms. So hopefully it'll be a good transition into any apartment complexes that they're living in. But we will have a group of interns working in the Office of Sustainability this fall, and one of their goals will be as ambassadors to their peers to educate them on what goes in certain bins and to make sure that they are actually recycling as well, going to some of the different apartment complexes, going to some of the sorority and fraternity houses and being in on, their chapter meetings and that type of thing, and really encouraging everyone just to be aware of what they're consuming and where where it should go.
One of the big unknowns back when this thing passed a year ago was how much it was going to cost. You know, what landlords and apartment companies were going to have to pay to get their haulers to actually pick up the recycling too, and then what would happen to that cost? Like, would landlords pass that straight along to the tenants, or were they going to eat some of it? How it was going to work, right? And a lot of it comes down to, like, how much do students value recycling? Like, what does it mean to them to have that option? What is your sense from talking to students in various roles throughout the years? What is your sense of how much something like this will be valued?
Yeah, I think recycling is just, it's absolutely necessary. It's not, it's something that they've been asking for years. Before this taking on this role, I taught at ISU for 11 years, and all the time in my classes I heard, what can we do about getting recycling in the apartments? What can we do about getting, recycling? So this is definitely something that they want. Really, it's antiquated that we didn't have it before, and so it is time that we have it, and the next step is really compost. So this is going to, I got an email just today about asking about compost, in not just in our town, but in on campus as well. So on to the next thing.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm speaking with Elizabeth Reed, who last month became program director for Illinois State University's Office of Sustainability. So, Elizabeth, what are your top priorities as you move into this this new position?
Yeah, I have lots of ideas and goals, but really what I want to do right now is just collect as much information as I can from our campus, learning from all of the different faculty, staff, and students, how they define sustainability, and then moving forward what they would like, different projects to be on campus. So I will be putting out a survey this fall for our campus community, so that way we can collect some of that information. And then we will put that into a strategic plan so we can really have a clear mission and some goals that we'd like to move forward. But as I mentioned, composting is a really big one. That is one that I hear a lot in different meetings. We compost on the back end at our dining halls, but I'm hearing from a lot of students that they would like to have compost in other areas on campus with takeout containers and things like that from the dining halls. Those are actually compostable, but we don't really have any place to put them. So they just go into the landfill or by mistake into recycling. So that's something we'd like to investigate further and see about how we can have some compost bins on campus.
So what are some of the biggest challenges that ISU faces in terms of sustainability?
You know, sustainability is so interdisciplinary. It really involves everyone to be successful. It covers so many different areas of campus, whether that be in campus dining or in housing, in catering, in obviously our curriculum as well, and just in the waste that we consume too. So there are so many different areas in order for it to really be successful. We really need to have everybody on board. And so far, through all of my meetings that I've had with people across campus, it's just been really positive. Everyone is working towards, a common goal in that way. So it's really exciting.
Well, we've talked about the multifamily recycling ordinance, so allowing students who live in off-campus apartments the opportunity to recycle. We were a little bit behind the curve there, and now we are catching up to the curve. And I want to know, are there other areas where ISU is a little bit behind the curve when it comes to this world of sustainability? Things that you want to hit kind of in those first few years as you take over this new job?
I think some of our purchasing as far as different products probably could be a little bit, in line with some other universities, and thinking about just how we manage some different offices even on campus. Like, some universities have a green office certification, so that's something that I'm excited to start in the near future. And just considering the products, whether that be at concession stands, at different athletic events, straws, things like that, there's a lot of, places that are just removing those as options. So kind of, examining some of our purchases, I think, would be a place to start.
We're going to enter into the great straw debate of 2019?
Yes. Those plastic straws are definitely an enemy of the sustainability director, for sure.
And we joke about this, but ISU has a lot of competing needs, right? So ISU wants to keep tuition reasonable, but it wants to have good programs, good facilities, good meal plans. Mm-hmm. It wants housing to be good but affordable. It wants to pay faculty and staff like what they deserve. So how do you make the case that sustainability should fit into that equation and fit in and in a really meaningful way?
Well, you know, sustainability is actually being very cost effective in many ways. It's reducing what you have. It's making things work more efficiently. More than anything, the students are demanding it. So if we want, you know, as far as recruitment and retention, we have to be listening to our students and moving forward in that way.
Elizabeth Reed, while you are not new to campus, you've been on campus, you're new to this particular role in the Office of Sustainability, but prior to this, people may know you from the Department of Family and Consumer Sciences. One of the things you did, I mean, you're weaving a lot of this stuff into your coursework and I'm sure your research as well, but one of the things you did was Fix It Fridays. And I wonder
right.
if you could talk about that.
Yeah, so sometimes people are like, well, how did you go from a fashion professor to the sustainability director? But, you know, the fashion industry is about the second biggest polluter after oil. So it was something that I focused on a lot within my textiles class and other fashion classes, talking about fast fashion, just the overall environmental impact of the textile and fashion industries as a whole. Fix It Friday came out of a lot of those conversations and that research and thinking about ways that we can educate students while also, you know, really having their hands on, you know, being a part of the fixing the problem. And so Fix It Friday is a program here at ISU where students set up a table and sewing machines and they fix whatever clothing item people might, you know, need. It has, like, you know, just a hole or button that's missing, and they will fix it for them for free. We set up on the quad a couple times. We set up around campus in different places, and then we also go out into the community. We've been all over the community, lots of different coffee shops and both public libraries and retirement homes, and we are always very busy when we go out. So there is definitely a need for it. It's just small fixes. We don't want to take business away from any local alteration shops or anything like that. We're just encouraging everyone to fix what might be broken instead of, you know, we're so quick to discard some of those items. Mm-hmm. So,
well, projects like that, it leads me into my next question here. So with sustainability, you can do it like top down. You can have, a university initiative to install water bottle fillers mm-hmm. or something on the quad, you know, very top down thing. But you can also, you know, bake it in so it kind of bubbles up from the bottom where you've got individual faculty members doing individual small projects that, you know, grow on their own. And then you've got this kind of culture of sustainability. I wonder if you can talk about the top down versus bottom up sort of sustainability model.
Sure. Well, I think that bottom up is really at the heart of what I want to do, because I think this is a place of learning, right? So in every action that you're taking on campus, whether it just be walking through campus and needing to refill your water bottle, one of the things we're also trying to work on is ISU becoming a fair trade certified university, and that means offering some certain fair trade products at the dining halls and other areas across campus, along with it being in our curriculum and that type of thing, which it already is. But, you know, you think about somebody like maybe that's a nursing student and they're going to get their coffee in the morning at the dining hall, and they might never have had a class where they learn about fair trade, but here they are just getting their coffee in the morning and there's a little sign or, you know, statement about what this fair trade coffee is, and they're learning about fair trade. So I love the bottom-up approach where we are infusing some of these things just along with your everyday habits and your life here on campus, whether that be students or faculty and staff too, and so that it just becomes part of our everyday.
That's Elizabeth Reed, who last month became program director for Illinois State University's Office of Sustainability. Thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Thank you.
I'm Ryan Denham.
Last week, WGLT reported in-depth about the kickoff to Normal's new multifamily recycling ordinance. You can find that full story at WGLT.org.
Follow GLT News at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. GLT's award-winning online presence brings you news when it happens, day and night and on weekends. Join the community of users ready to discuss GLT's thoughtful, in-depth reporting and breaking news. Recognized by the Illinois Associated Press for best digital presence, this is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois State University's two basketball teams will soon be traveling to a place that's not exactly known for basketball, but the ISU men's and women's teams are going to Italy for more than just hoops. Also, a cultural experience, as WGLT's Eric Stock explains.
The two teams are traveling separately in early August to spend 10 days in Italy. Both will play three exhibition games and will take in some of Italy's history, visiting the Vatican Museum, Sistine Chapel, the Roman Colosseum, and other landmarks. While the trip will be about much more than just basketball, eighth-year ISU men's coach Dan Muller hopes the trip can help his team lay the building blocks to return to the top of the Missouri Valley Conference. Muller says this overseas trip will take players out of their comfort zones, something he plans to do a lot after a disappointing season last year.
Well, that's the most valuable part, without a doubt, is the team bonding, the team experience. New faces, that helps, because when you go overseas, two things, a lot of people don't speak English, right? And so you're forced to come together because you got to hang together. The second part is, a lot of times, those cell phones, that costs a lot of money to be on that phone all day. And so sometimes guys' phones will only work on Wi-Fi, right? And so they're not on their phones all the time. And so those two things will just bring guys closer together. And then you experience new things together, which brings anybody together, right? Pictures, seeing things, hopefully learning a lot. We were going to do tours and teach them a lot about the history of Italy. So much to gain, so much value from it. The games are critical, for sure. The practices are really important. But that bonding experience, you can't put a price on it.
After the transition from last year, you've had some time to reflect on the end of the 2018-19 campaign. Disappointing finish after being atop the Missouri Valley late in the season. Any takeaways from you about how last season ended and how you carry over into a stronger start to the season?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of takeaways. I did a lot of reflecting. You always, after every end of every season, you look back, or I do, and try to figure out what I could have done better, what I should have done better. Last year was my most difficult year personally as a head coach, because I thought that we were furthest away from what our potential, okay? And that was hard for me to take. And so as I look back and reflect and see the things that I should have done better, leading better, get different people in different positions possibly. But in the end, we just didn't compete hard enough. We did for a little while, and that's, we were in first place, 7-3, and then of course we had that huge losing streak. We didn't handle adversity well enough. And so what can I do better? What should I have done better to help our guys when they get to those situations?
That's ISU coach Dan Muller talking with GLT's Eric Stock. The NCAA allows each program to go overseas once every 4 years. Those teams get 10 additional practices during the off season. This is Sound Ideas.
When I was a lad, I served a term as office boy to an attorney's firm. I cleaned the windows and I swept the floor, and I polished up the handle of the big front door. I polished up that handle so carefully that now I am the ruler of the Queen's Navy.
He polished up the handle so carefully that now he is the ruler of the Queen's
Navy. That's one of the most politically scathing songs from the light opera HMS Pinafore by Gilbert and Sullivan. America, like most countries, has had eras in which class divisions have been stark and caused public friction. That makes this particular nautical comedy opera resonate. HMS Pinafore is a satirical take on the British etiquette and social class. The Prairie Fire Theater production of Pinafore opens Thursday at Community Players Stage in Bloomington. Bob Mangiolardi, a cast member, says Pinafore and director, he says Pinafore is still relevant today.
The truth of the matter is, some people love Gilbert and Sullivan. Some people love Gilbert and Sullivan, just think that it's some of the greatest music. They find, all of the parodies of social convention and romance and politics. They find that really refreshing. The language is, you know, just very clever. And then there's some people that just think it's really silly, but I think they don't, the people that think it's really silly and not interesting are the ones that don't really, haven't looked at the text that carefully. Just to give you an example, like the first song that Sir Joseph sings is this song called When I Was a Lad. And basically, it's many people's story, many famous politicians' story. He talks about how he was an office boy, and through the six verses, by the time at the end, he's then the ruler of the Queen's Navy. He was completely he'd never even been on a ship. By the end of the song, he's the ruler of the Queen's Navy.
This is not particularly tied to any era, but can't most eras and most political administrations, audiences relate to that for those administrations?
Of course. I mean, if they think about people that they know, and I'm sure we can all think of somebody in our lives that, you know, they started off as nothing and then they became, you know, at the top of the heap. So there's a lot in there that I think is timeless and classic and never really goes away. But I suppose what people like most is the music. The tunes are really
summarize the plot a little bit more.
Oh, geez.
It's rollicking.
I was hoping you'd do that. Well, it's basically takes place on the HMS Pinafore, and the cast of characters includes Sir Joseph, who is the head of the Admiralty, and he is falling in love with Josephine, who is this young, much younger woman who supposedly is kind of in his class. And of course, this is a lot about class and the silliness of class distinctions. The captain of the ship is Captain Corcoran, and his daughter is Josephine, and he's kind of tried to fix up Sir Joseph, who's much, much older than Josephine. Rafe is one of the sailors, and he and Josephine, of course, have fallen in love, but they can't really marry because he's considered lower class, and she is the daughter of the captain, so she's of a higher class. Then there's kind of this Miss Buttercup, who's kind of like a worker on the around town, and she's of a lower class too. Well, it turns out in the course of the events, like Shakespeare, like many other things, Rafe, who was the sailor, and the captain were switched at birth. And so in reality, the captain is now lower class and Rafe is higher class. So Rafe can marry Josephine because now they're of the same class, and Sir Joseph can't marry Josephine because they're of a different class. And so everybody winds up with the right person at the end.
Even though romantically it's satisfying, this is perhaps true not just of Gilbert and Sullivan, but a lot of biting social satire and commentary. In making fun of it, does it confirm the existing order, the existing class system?
Well, of course. As it parodies it, it shows you for what it is and also how ridiculous it is. And yet it's still going on at the same time. So it's... Now, you have both things going on simultaneously.
Tell us about your cast.
Well, it's a great cast. We've got singers really from all over the place. We have a good contingent from Bloomington Normal, but we've got four really fine singers from U of I, grad students over there that wanted to train opera singers that are trying to, you know, get more experience. So they're coming over from Champaign. A couple of Wesleyan, really talented Wesleyan students. I'm in the cast myself. We've got some really good high school students, some adults from the community. So it's a really, really nicely varied cast. I guess another significant thing is that the director is Dawn Harris. She's a professor and an opera director at the U of I. She's kind of accepted as a real Gilbert Sullivan aficionado. And so she does a lot of directing, and some of her staging can kind of be traced back to the doily cart era, since she was principal performer at the Ohio Light Opera for several years. So she really knows Gilbert and Sullivan, and so we're having a lot of fun with that.
Sometimes language and clever use of language really doesn't stand the test of time. Why is that not so with Gilbert and Sullivan?
Well, I mean, it's kind of like Shakespeare. It takes some energy. I mean, even as we gotten into the rehearsal process, you really have to take some time to, number one, kind of translate what they're saying, and then just the way it has to be articulated and kind of falls off the tongue. It's not quite as dense as, let's say, Shakespeare, but it has a certain kind of complexity and rhythm, and, you know, it's the long shape of the phrases that is not conversational, let's just say. It's really much more, in some ways, literary, and so it just takes time to really wade through it.
We have the Midwest Opera Company. We have the Illinois Shakespeare Festival. We have Heartland Theater. We have Coalescence Theater Project. We have Prairie Fire Theater. They all serve somewhat different missions and different niches. Is there anything in the Twin Cities that is missing?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. Let's see. To me, the thing that's missing is a centralized performance space. Now, this is just my opinion. I don't know if anybody else would agree with me, but we really don't have, let's say, either a classic theater, kind of like thinking of the Virginia Theater in Champaign. Decatur has an old kind of vaudeville theater. We don't have a theater that's many of the area groups could use that has a pit. Like, part of the problem is we always have orchestra for our productions, and some groups are getting away from that because it's just too expensive and they don't want to deal with it, and whatever the reason, they don't like it, I don't know. And certainly easier.
It's a tougher lift, yeah.
Yeah, and certainly it's easier if you just have a CD or you just have piano or whatever, you know. So, but we want to have orchestra. We just feel like that's part of what we do.
Prairie Fire Theater will be performing Gilbert and Sullivan's HMS Pinafore at Community Players Theater Thursday, August 1st to Sunday, August 4th. Tickets can be bought online at prairiefiretheater.org. 7:30 showings, and Sunday we'll have a 3 p.m. matinee. Let's listen to more from HMS Pinafore.
As a mountain bird, his energetic fist should be ready to resist a dictatorial world.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Ryan Denham and Eric Stock. Thanks as well to Normal City Manager Pam Reese for stopping by. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.